Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Joe DeVille, who's a lecturer in mobile work at Lancaster Uni, about his new book, which is published by Routledge in 2015, called Lived Economies of Default, Consumer Credit, Debt Collection, and the Capture of Affect. Welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. This is a fascinating book that talks to lots and lots of different things about how we live our lives in contemporary society, both in terms of the kind of everyday mundaneness of using credit cards and stuff like that, through to really big questions about how we theorise people's kind of emotions, their subjectivities, stuff like that. And I wonder if we could kick off by thinking about one of the words in the title.
Sure.
Default.
Yes.
So what is default? What does that term mean, and why was it kind of important to the book?
So on the one hand, it's a technical term referring to the moment at which a creditor deems that a borrower has broken the terms of their credit agreement. And I think for many years it kind of stayed there as a technical term used within the industry and understood by people working in and around the industry. But I guess one of the reasons that it ended up in the title is that it's become something, a word that captures something about our age to a degree. You know, speaking right now on the cusp of at a moment when Greece is potentially on the verge of default, or that's certainly something that's in the air. I think in many ways we're at a moment in which default, or the threat of default, has become not the defining, but a defining concept or a way of thinking about our relations to economies of all sorts. And of course, this all started with the sequence of defaults on subprime mortgages in the States. So I guess if you trace some of the kind of issues that we're experiencing in a variety of global economies, these can be traced back to a series of defaults overlaid with constant threat of default. And so that was the kind of backdrop, but I particularly am interested in consumer credit defaults. So these are people who are defaulting on their consumer credit debts. So these are debts on credit cards, on personal loans. These tend not to be secured on property, so we're not talking about default on home loans, which is something that hasn't really been investigated in much depth.
Where did the interest in idea of default generally and then consumer credit come from? Was it something you were working on previously in your academic career? Or
yeah, so I mean, the book kind of comes to a degree out of my PhD research, though I've built on it quite a lot since then. And I started it well before the so-called crisis broke, and I became interested in the proliferation of consumer credit, which was being talked about to a degree at the time, both academically and within popular discourse as a problem. So there was a kind of, to a degree, an awareness that there was this spread, this ballooning amount of consumer credit out there. But one of the things that I felt was that it wasn't really being investigated perhaps with enough nuance academically. I mean, there's some great sort of path-defining texts out there. People like George Ritzer writing about proliferation of credit and so forth. But no one, I think, had really looked in sufficient enough detail at some of the kind of real specificities of our daily interceptions with consumer credit. So that was my starting point. And the first point of my research was to go and speak to some debtors. I was particularly interested in people who are struggling with their debts and with high levels of debt. And as soon as I went to speak to them, one of the things that you realise is the specific consequences of default, of having broken the terms of your credit agreement. And what that effectively means is being subject to the incursions and solicitations of the debt collection industry, broadly defined to include both, I'll come on to this probably in more detail later, but external debt collectors and creditors themselves collecting on outstanding debt. So, you know, when I was speaking to people, our conversation was continually interrupted by the ringing phone. People would take me round their homes, show me folders of bulging paper containing letters from debt collectors. And that, I guess, led me to focus down specifically on this matter of default, rather than just sort of generic over-indebtedness. I became specifically interested in the condition of what happens when you break this bond that you're meant to sort of treat with care, purportedly with a creditor. What actually happens, and what are some of the organisational processes that surrounded this particular component of the credit industry?
Your way of kind of getting into that, framing that set of discussions that you had with people, both as, you know, in the jobs and on the receiving end of kind of the credit industry, is through quite a variety of theoretical starting points. But I think two of the big ones are science and technology studies and actor network theory. And I wonder if you could say a bit about what they are and how they're relevant to the investigation in the book.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the book is heavily influenced by a variety of approaches that come out of science and technology studies, of actor network theory. So there's also a strand of economic sociology, I think, has been heavily influenced by that. So there's a series of translations, I guess you could call them, appropriately enough, in relation to that body of work, through which I draw on that work. And I'd say that's kind of one pole, one important pole of the book. And what I take from that work, and I do critically engage with it as well, but what I do take from that work is its attention on the material, and I guess on the mundane, and in my case within market settings, within and surrounding market settings anyway. And I think why that was really helpful for me was to focus on the specific makeup of these sets of encounters between effectively creditors on the one side and borrowers / defaulters on the other, to be able to sort of trace some of the specific ways in which, on the one hand, a set of organisations were attempting to manage, to attach, as I refer to it in the book, people to their credit products through a specific set of technologies, a specific set of what I call devices. These devices can be things as mundane as a collections letter to a particular collections script that somebody might use, to a set of algorithmically informed analytical techniques which allow you to potentially categorise debtors in a certain way. So I guess it's that attention to the kind of to the mundane material composition of markets and the relationships between people and organisations that I think this body of work was help. That's why I guess that body of work was helpful to me in that respect. Although I guess where I critically or have some sort of hesitations about some of this work is that, on the one hand, I think sometimes its accounts have been a little instrumental, a little clean, I would say. And that links to, I guess, the second kind of pole in the book, which is affect theory, which also has materiality at its core. However, the kind of emphasis is less on the specific devices and more on the body as a material site. And I guess what the book tries to do is to bring these two approaches into dialogue, into fruitful dialogue, not necessarily a synthesis by any means, but to bring some of, I guess, you could call it the attention to messy and embodied life, which I think affect theory is particularly good at detecting, you could call it, to an STS-informed economic sociology, which some of your listeners may well be quite familiar with this, but which I guess most famously or most the most kind of prominent exponent of a kind of STS-informed economic sociology would be someone like Michel Calon. So bringing this kind of work to a kind of Calonian economic sociology.
Yeah, in that body of work, they you see the kind of attention on a whole range of different devices, things like shopping carts,
yeah,
as you know, making kind of transactions possible and stuff like this. And one of the things you do in the first substantive chapter in the book is to think through why it is people borrow, why
yeah,
it is people get credit, by discussing the credit card. And I think that's an interesting device perspective,
yeah,
on what could be just a sort of, you know, fairly sort of standard sort of psychological explanation, or, you know, kind of boring mainstream economics explanation. So I wonder if you could talk through how the device perspective on the credit card gives us a kind of a different perspective on what drives people to borrow.
Yeah, sure. So the first chapter, in a way, is a kind of, it's an unusual chapter in the context of the book as a whole, because most of the book isn't actually about the causal forces that drive people to borrow. The majority of the book is on what happens when borrowing becomes a problem. But I kind of felt that I had to answer that question whenever I sort of introduced what I was researching to people, both academic and non-academic. The first question that people tend to ask is, oh, right, so is your book going to explain why people get into debt?
Yeah.
Which is fair enough. And I, in some senses, I saw that question as a provocation to the kind of devices approach, because the conventional answer to that, and these conventional answers aren't wrong necessarily, it's just that they're very well rehearsed, and I think there is in some sense always a need to kind of come at these questions afresh. So of course things like poverty, money management skills, the marketing of credit, the forming of certain subjectivities in certain ways, all these play a huge role in the reasons behind why people borrow. However, one of the things that I thought hadn't really been explored in much depth was the role of these mundane devices of consumer credit themselves, specifically payment cards, and specifically the credit card. The credit card is interesting, it's kind of this symbol of consumer credit. So when you look at pretty much any academic and many popular books about consumer credit, on the front you'll find a credit card, and yet in these books you'll often find virtually no discussion of the credit card itself. So I started to kind of look into the credit card, look into some of its history, and what you find is that this very mundane device, this thing that we have in our purses and wallets, we often forget about, played a crucial role in the expansion of consumer credit and then actually in the acceleration of the consumer credit market, particularly in the US in the 1950s and the 1960s, and then in the UK in the 1970s. And what you specifically find is the credit card being seen as a device that could actually effectively tempt people into borrowing. So in the US and then later in the UK, the initial approach of the credit card industry was to effectively mail credit cards to people completely unsolicited. So they would just send people credit cards in the post to people who they thought might be potential borrowers. And in the US in particular, this was done on a vast scale. There's a period called the Great Credit Card Race where these cards are getting sent to thousands and thousands of people. They're to all kinds of peculiar things, being allegedly being sent to children, to ex-cons. And this was huge. This was to an extent about kind of market share, grabbing kind of a piece of the consumer credit pie at the time. But there was more to it than that. The consumer credit industry were called in front of a committee in Washington, where they actually, in defense of this practice, produced experimental evidence of the fact that simply by putting a credit card in somebody's hand as opposed to making them fill in an application form for consumer credit, you could experimentally demonstrate that people they'd be far more likely to borrow. So this kind of historical evidence provides a nice sort of demonstration of the power of some of these mundane devices. These mundane devices aren't just passive in our wallets and purses. They in many ways act as affordances, act as lures for us to borrow, to engage with consumer credit. And second thing, I guess, is that the payment card industry are well aware of this. There's an ongoing, I guess, battle within the payment card industry to get us to transform the way that we use payment cards with the rise of contactless payment and so forth. And in the various marketing that surrounds this, you see quite explicitly the way in which the specific materiality of payment devices is invoked as having direct causal consequences. So these are some of the kind of things I look at in the first chapter. Not to, as I say, negate some of these kind of you could call them broader social forces, social and economic forces that drive consumer credit uptake, but to provide an alternate way through some of those debates.
So the kind of focus on market devices continues into the second chapter, where you're thinking through, I suppose, what you said earlier, that moment of when one stops being a kind of a potential customer who might be, you know, making money on interest payments and stuff, and ends up as a defaulting debtor, who, you know, has to be sort of dealt with in various ways. And you look at letters and telephone calls in the context as well as bringing effective theory in. And so I wonder if you could talk through what the role of things like letters and telephone calls are in moving defaulted debtors to repay.
Yeah. So certainly in the UK, and I imagine elsewhere, there's this idea about debt collection that it involves the burly male debt collector coming to your door, knocking on the door and demanding repayment, potentially taking bits, you're taking a TV, taking whatever else he can get his hands on in repayment for debt. This is an extremely niche part of the debt collection. The vast majority of contemporary debt collection work involves contact at a distance. And the two, I guess, the workhorses of contact at a distance in the debt collection industry are these two mundane technologies of the telephone call and the letter. Although it's increasingly being supplemented by things like email and SMS. But still, I'd say it's predominantly letters and phone calls. They're sort of tried and tested within the industry. When I say tested, I mean quite literally tested, and we can perhaps get onto that later. But so the second chapter, I guess, deals with what I would call the intimacies of default. It goes into people's homes and tries to understand with some precision what it means to live a life of default. And what it effectively means is to have to confront these two technologies on an extremely regular basis. Most mornings, I should say first of all, that most in the UK, it's typical for defaulting debtors to owe debts to multiple collectors. So a typical defaulting debtor may owe debts, let's say, 5 or 6 different creditors. Each one of those creditors will, in a situation of default, most likely be attempting to convince that debtor to repay them. And that's in fact, to repay them before they repay somebody else. So it's this kind of race. to get what in the industry is known as share of wallet. So you want to get as big a share of someone's wallet as you possibly can. Now, there are specific regulations in the UK that prevent collectors from quote-unquote harassing debtors, and that puts limits on, say, the amount of telephone calls that can be sent out, the amount of letters that can be sent out. But once you have this kind of interaction effect of different agencies contacting a defaulting debtor, cumulatively, what that feels like and how that's experienced by a defaulting debtor is as a kind of ongoing bombardment of solicitations, an extremely bewildering bombardment of solicitations. The phone ringing at pretty much, well, potentially from early in the morning and until relatively late in the evening. It's not uncommon for collectors to start making telephone calls at around 8 a.m., finish at around 8 p.m., sometimes later. Letters coming through the door demanding repayment, mixed in with things like other outstanding bills, utility bills, and so forth. And this generates a particular state, something that I describe in the book as a state of anxious anticipation. So a kind of constant forward-looking bodily and emotional state, which in which a debtor will be constantly expecting the next prompt, expecting the next solicitation. And what I kind of argue in that chapter is that this is not just a kind of byproduct of the situation of being in default. In many ways, this is quite deliberately created, embodied state on the part of the debt collection industry. This kind of intimate, anxious state acts as a real kind of opportunity for the collector that's looking to collect an outstanding debt. What it will be doing is trying to sort of insert itself into this milieu and to try and make its approach heard above, I guess, the noise of these various different solicitations. And the way it will do that is through a variety of threats and solicitations, not all of which are forcible. And it's this kind of mixture of these threats that makes up the kind of delivered both over the telephone and the letter that makes up the kind of the vast majority of the work of the collections industry.
Yeah, because you talk about this in more detail in chapter three, where you kind of describe the idea of kind of a debtor being attached to their debt. And I wonder if you could say, so what you mean by that, and how that works, because the rest of the book, I think, it is a very, you know, kind of interesting and detailed engagement with how this industry actually works.
So attachment, I guess, as I've already mentioned, is a kind of key conceptual device, I guess, to think about the relational composition of this specific organization or organizational account between organizations and individuals. What I try and do is look at attachment operating across a variety of, I guess you call them, modalities. So all markets involve attachment. That is attempts by organizations to try and integrate themselves into our lives in such a way that we buy the things that they want us to buy, consume the services that we want them to consume in a certain way. And that's no different with credit. When it comes to consumer credit, there are all kinds of devices that are designed, on the one hand, to kind of tempt us all, or to convince us that taking out credit is a good idea. These are kind of potential attachment devices, and that they're also, and because of the fact that this is a financial product that sort of stretches out over time, this becomes particularly important. There are also a series of legal devices as well that effectively attach us particularly firmly to consumer credit. So when we sign a consumer credit agreement, we are making an agreement to repay that agreement according to a particular schedule. This is an attachment device. This is the kind of legal attachment which forms the basis of all contemporary credit contracts and credit agreements. So that's kind of one modality of attachment, the kind of legal modality. But there are a range of other attachments which constitute our relationship to credit on the one hand, and on the other, which credit itself can become attached to. So one might be, for instance, the guilt that we might feel about not repaying. So
the effect of attachment.
Yeah, exactly. So that might, so we might feel, so well, there is a legal obligation, fine, but then we might, on top of that, might be layered the kind of feeling that we should be repaying. As we, all of us, as we go through our daily life, we have a range of other attachments. We have attachments to our families, to our, the places we live, to our friends and so forth. One of the things I look at in the book, in the second chapter and to a degree in the third, is the way that these again become affordances or for the collections industry. Well, certainly what happens is you find, what happens is that credit becomes mixed up, becomes entwined with some of these attachments. So this ostensibly sort of dyadic relationship between creditor and borrower becomes spread around a range of other parties, ranging from other family members to friends and to a range of other potential advisors. So this is kind of some of the ways that this attachment becomes distributed. What I do in chapter three is look at the kind of long history of the beginnings, the way that the industry began to think about a bit more strategically about how to intersect with some of these domestic attachments. There's actually quite a nice kind of like serendipitous point of connection here. Back in the early days of the consumer credit industry in the United States, upon situations of default, the courts would often issue a writ of body attachment, which effectively compelled a debtor to appear before a court. So this is the kind of writ of body attachment, which provides quite a nice summary, I think, of what really is at stake here. When you borrow, you are attached to your debt. The way that happens has changed over time. So historically, we had debtors' prisons, for instance. People could be compelled to appear in front of court, and potentially people could be incarcerated for non-repayment. We've, in most countries, not all, have abolished imprisonment for non-repayment of debt. However, in its place, a series of techniques replaced these kind of juridical, these very forceful juridical approaches. I mean, there are of course still other juridical approaches that are important nowadays. And this is what I document in chapter three, where I talk about, or look at the way in which the debt collection industry, in particular in the US, which is in some sense the testing ground for the majority of technologies of consumer credit, the industry in the 1940s and 1950s started to realise that it as an industry was perhaps more so than many other industries, and perhaps if not any other industry, was really concerned with negotiating this very intimate relationship that people had to their debt and to their credit products. Back then, as in the UK, as in many countries, collection of consumer credit meant people effectively going to your door, knocking your door and asking for repayment of a debt. This was often done by individuals, kind of working in very small companies, often kind of sole traders, effectively going to people's doors. In industry literature in the 1940s and 1950s, what you start to find is this industry realising that it was a business concerned explicitly with the management of emotions. This was a real revelation to the industry at the time. This is kind of coming in the context of psychology as a discipline was coming to the fore. Suddenly, the industry started talking to one another in terms of the management of debtor emotions. The industry started to categorise debtors in terms of their emotions. So you find kind of endless lists of debtor emotions in industry literature at the time. So it was thought, well, a debtor has 10 typical emotions ranging from fear to anxiety to pride and so on and so forth. And debt collectors started talking about themselves as practical psychologists. Their business was really the management of some of these kind of intimate encounters that they were having with debtors on their doorsteps. That was all well and good, but a lot of this was effectively just talking about what they were already doing using new language. It didn't really necessarily change that much about their day-to-day business. In the 1960s, however, with the rise of, and again in the US, the rise of automation, So this is particularly on punch card automation. What this enabled the debt collection industry to do was to start to really operationalize some of these concepts. So you had people talking about, well, can we devise an ideal letter trajectory? So a sequence of letters that are sent to a defaulting debtor that will really maximize this state of anxiety. And they talked about it as anxiety. They talked about it in those terms. One particular experiment I talk about took place in the 1960s involving around 600,000 letters, so a huge number of letters, a huge sample, which effectively involved sending out this seven-letter sequence, sending out sequences of letters and trying to understand exactly what prompts would lead to kind of optimal success financially, and how you could effectively manage over this course of a sequence of letters this kind of anxious state of a debtor. You didn't want to push them too hard at the beginning. You kind of wanted to start gently, give them a kind of opportunity to repay at first, and then kind of save your big guns until to the end of the process. This is something that had always been done within the collection industry, but it always been done on a kind of an ad hoc basis. There was some kind of rudimentary experimentation, but it was very, very, very basic. But with the kind of rise of automation, with the ability to start to kind of customize letters quite simply via these kind of proto forms of computerization, with the ability to start to tabulate the responses you were getting back, you could really start to do some kind of effective analytics on this. And suddenly you have this combination of the industry realizing its work is centrally concerned with the management of affect, I would call it, or the emotion they would call it, although I should say those two things are not necessarily equating directly to one another, mapping on just on a kind of one-to-one basis, but anyway, I'll leave that to one side. Combined with these processes, this kind of proto-computerization, really marked the point at which the industry started to become sophisticated and start to realize that it could really start to, with some precision, become entwined into people's daily lives, and that it could manage some of this kind of process of entwinement or process of attachment. And these kind of experimental technologies, I guess, the logic that informs them are very much the logics that inform the more sophisticated contemporary collections work today, in countries like the US, in countries like the UK, with extensive consumer credit markets.
I suppose if that's a story of the rise of a social scientific society as much as it is mm-hmm. particular industry techniques, what's yes. the story of what actually goes on in a debt collection agency now? And that's the subject of chapter four. And I wonder if you can maybe set that social scientific story in terms of what, you know, the kind of the working life is like in one of these businesses.
Yeah, so it's important to emphasize that, I mean, this is a diverse industry, and when you talk about some of these practices, one shouldn't assume that they are happening in all companies. And that's actually not a defense so much as to say that a lot of companies involved in the work of debt collection are quite unsophisticated and haven't necessarily adopted some of the more sophisticated techniques. So if you were just to rely on industry literature, which tends to talk about the latest techniques and so forth, you might get a slightly kind of skewed understanding of what actually does go on in some of these companies. I mean, there is still this kind of a portion, I think it's a shrinking portion, but there's a portion who won't use any of this kind of experimental techniques, we'll just kind of have their tried and tested approaches, using kind of forms of lay expertise, you could call them, to kind of inform their collections work. So I went into a number of collections, I think three different collections agencies, spent some time observing what they were doing. These were some of the kind of bigger collections companies here in the UK, three of the biggest actually here in the UK. Two of which, I think it's important to understand, there are three main components to the collections industry. One of those is what you would call internal collections work. So this is collections work that is being done in-house by creditors themselves. That is part of the debt collection industry, even though it's not often thought about as such. The other two parts are the contingency debt collection industry and the debt purchase industry. Debt purchase industry rose to prominence here in the UK in the late 90s and the early 2000s. What that effectively involved was companies buying debts wholesale from the original creditor. This is a model that was developed in the US, I think mainly in the 90s, and it led to kind of a boom in collections because suddenly creditors realized they had all this old debt that they weren't really doing much with, and they could actually get some money with. You know, they would sell this at, you know, a couple of cents in the dollar to an external company, but still that was great. That gave them some extra capital, and it could take some potential bad debt off their balance sheet, which is very, very important. This is the debt purchase industry, and this is, I guess, before the crisis, it looked like the debt purchase industry was soon going to be all there was when it came to debt collection. For particularly ironic reasons, that didn't come to pass. Partly because one of the things with the financial crisis that happened was that this was an industry that was itself hugely reliant on debt to fund its operations, and they needed to borrow to take out loans to effectively buy some of this credit. With the credit crisis of 2007-2008, there was a huge contraction of credit, business credit, that actually put a real squeeze on their operations, ironically, led to some of these companies effectively going out of business as well. So that's debt purchase. And then the other kind of more long-standing part of the external collection industry is contingency collections. What that effectively means involves are companies working on commission. So the ownership of the debt will remain with the creditor, but they'll collect debt on commission. And often what the creditor will do, they'll have a number of different companies working on a particular sort of debt portfolio, and these companies are effectively in competition with one another to try and collect on this debt. And I won't get too much into detail about that. So I spent time at two contingency agencies and one at debt purchase industry. I'd say that, I mean, one of the things spending some time at two contingency agencies was helpful in highlighting is the way in which you have specialism within the collections industry. So some companies specialize in collecting debt which is older, which is more low margin. So one of the agencies that I spent some time at specialized in collecting debt of that sort, whereas another specialized in much debt that was much fresher. So this is the kind of company that a creditor would perhaps go to as the first port of call on a potentially set of accounts with large outstanding credit balances. And one of the things you see is these companies tailor their approaches accordingly. So the kind of company that deals with older debt, I mean, to a large extent, the kind of the stereotype would be that sitting in a collections call center would involve listening to people constantly shouting down the phone. That isn't necessarily the case, and that's not necessary to say, not to say that from the debtor's point of view, this isn't experienced as a potentially very stressful conversation. It's just that the business model of some of these larger collection companies effectively involves really just pushing at the margins of very small debts. So just getting people to increase their payments from £5 to £10 a month, and crucially keeping people repaying. So this is a kind of business that involves kind of the long-term management of some of these people who have been in default for months, for potentially years. And the best case scenario for somebody like that, from the point of view of the debt collection company, the best case scenario for them is that their situation is going to change. They're going to get some inheritance. They're going to find a job, although for many people that's a remote possibility, or certainly a job that pays them sufficient that they can really make a big dent in their debts. But still, there's a kind of waiting game there. So in some sense, what you want to do is keep people attached to their debts until something better comes along. And so in some senses, they kind of operate to a degree like customer services in part of their operations. But then, of course, another part of their operations does involve pushing for debt, and they do for more money. And they do that in quite sophisticated ways, in quite understated ways sometimes. But that's kind of part of the business model, and then the agencies that deal with more of the kind of fresher debt that then you start to see some of the more aggressive approaches. And I was able to listen to sort of databases of recorded telephone calls, and I go through some of those telephone calls in the book to look at some of the techniques that I use. Debt purchase was particularly interesting because when you look at debt purchase, what you have is a whole collections routine from beginning to end. You can sort of see it over the whole course of a company. So historically, this process would be divided up. You'd have the original creditor, the original credit card lender, for instance, and they'd do some of the collections and then pass it to an external company. They might work here for a while, then they pass it to another external company. What the debt purchase industry has specialised in is bringing all of this stuff in-house. Well, I should say some debt purchasers actually buy debt and then they do some analytics and they sell some of the debts on to other companies and they kind of, so their business is a kind of middleman. But for some of the bigger debt purchasers and the one I spent some time at, you can actually witness the whole collections routine from beginning to end. So they take over debt pretty soon after it's gone into default, and they manage it potentially up until they decide they can't collect on it anymore. And then you can start to see some of these techniques that I was talking about were developed in the US in the 1960s really in action. You see analytics being used to work out how exactly to prioritise debtors. You have in the collection company that I was observing, you have the call centre force being divided into different teams, and I call them the green team, the orange team, the red team. That's not their actual names, but different teams. And these deal with debtors at different parts of the different stages in the collection process. So the green team, for instance, deals with people in a fairly light touch way, ranging from at the other end of the call centre. The red team, who deals with people who are much closer to legal action, will be much more aggressive, will be much more forceful in their dealings with debtors. So this is kind of one way in which you have this kind of process of the affective management, of the strategic management of affective intensity, I call it in the book. This in turn is then coupled to some of this analytics. So a debt portfolio will be subject to some of this analytics, and then just to give an example of the green team, has a particular routine which involves sending a number of letters to debtors. So three letters, each letter is in turn followed up by a phone call as a matter of course. But after the first letter, the sort of gentle letter, what you find happening is that debtors will then be categorised according to quite sophisticated analysis that's been done about them to try and determine what kind of debtor they are and what kinds of response then will work best with them. If they're deemed effectively low risk, so they don't have a huge outstanding balance, they've shown themselves through a variety of metrics to be the kind of people that repay in a relatively straightforward manner, then perhaps they'll stay with the green team. If not, however, they may sort of leapfrog the green team and go straight to one of the other teams, straight potentially to the orange team, potentially straight to the red team, to this pre-legal team. And what that effectively allows the collections company to do is kind of act preemptively, to be able to kind of manage debtors in a much more sophisticated way, and to be able to shuttle them around these different sort of teams that operate within this call centre. You also had, just as the final point on this, you also have within this call centre something which has kind of been effectively outlawed now here in the UK, and that is you had another team which effectively was posing as a separate organisation. So it had a separate kind of identity. Letters were sent from using different letterheads, and this is what I call trading styles, and that I talk about more in chapter 5. But there, so what you have there is effectively the debt purchaser would quote unquote pass out the, and once the debt got particularly far down the process, would pass it out to this quote unquote external company, which in fact was just sitting, you know, a few feet away from one of the other teams. And this process was very common in the collection industry, and it's something that the payday lender Wonga got into trouble for recently. Although in some senses you could say that they were not unfairly victimised, but it had not been recognised the degree to which this was a sort of endemic practice within the collection industry, and it has been for a while now. As I say, has changed recently.
It's really interesting because that fourth chapter and the fifth chapter as well, the kind of the lifting the lid on how these organisations work, gives us a new perspective on, I suppose, the classic kind of, here is, you know, a well-built middle-aged man who's going to, you know, knock at your door and ask you for your television. But it also points us towards the conclusion of the book, which tries to engage with ideas about, to an extent, kind of escape and resistance, and as you call it, sort of market detachment.
Yeah.
I wonder, as a, you know, kind of maybe slightly optimistic note, to come to a conclusion on is what does the book tell us about how we might do these things differently, how we might do kind of economy and society differently, particularly in terms of the stressful, anxious, effective elements of this part of the economy?
Well, I guess there are two ways I guess I'd answer that. One is perhaps less optimistic, and that is that I think one of the things that are kind of what you could call a device-inspired approach to the study of this particular market, of the credit market, I think shows is the degree to which what you could call opacity is built into this particular kind of set of market encounters. So transparency is obviously something that's seen as a kind of regulatory ideal in relation to consumer credit. Often politicians and policymakers look at transparency as a way of solving market problems. More transparency leads, in theory, to better markets, more efficient markets. These are kind of better and fairer outcomes for everyone. I, in a kind of pessimistic way, find it almost impossible to imagine what a genuinely transparent credit market would be.
Particularly in terms of the techniques you've been talking about.
Particularly in terms of the techniques we've been talking about. I mean, so when it comes to lending, some efforts we made, for instance, to there's this underlying opacity, which isn't actually what I'm talking about. There's this underlying opacity with credit, as with many financial products, and that is the uncertainty of the future. So you can never with any complete confidence predict the future, and that obviously is an opacity which you are dealing with as a potential user of a financial product. But you know, to give regulators their credit, they have taken some steps to address that in relation to borrowing. So you know, when you take out a credit card now, you'll have things like a table that will show you, you know, likely potential different scenarios and how much you might have to repay in the different scenarios. And so yeah, fair enough, that kind of makes it kind of increases transparency to a degree. But what I think is often missed when talking about credit is this kind of flip side to lending, which is collection. All credit that is lent will ultimately have to be collected. When you receive your credit statement every month in the post, that is a soft collections device. Okay, that's not particularly one that may not, as long as you haven't borrowed too much, as long as you can afford to repay that, it may not cause you much in the way of anxiety, it may not cause you much in the way of stress, you go on with the business of repaying and all well and good. However, there's always going to be many people potentially, who are not going to be able to repay their debts that they took out. And the credit industry, this is a systemic part of the credit industry. And for that reason, there is the debt collection industry. And this industry, I think in some ways, has enabled the existence of the industry, and as in many ways enabled creditors to kind of outsource a lot of the ethically problematic aspects of consumer credit to this kind of external industry, which is seen as the industry which deals with the kind of aberrations of people's encounters with credit. However,
it's not a bank that's acting unethically. It's not a bank that's pursuing you. It's not a bank that's making.
Even though, in fact, because partly as a result of the kind of global economic crisis, default has come to be seen as increasingly important to the work of creditors, so they actually have got far more sophisticated than themselves doing the work of collection. So in actual fact, many creditors now are actually quite sophisticated collectors as well. But when it comes to collection, the debt collections, opacity is absolutely essential. Because you can't lock up people now for default, the industry has had to effectively create a sequence, an almost bewildering array of techniques to solicitations and prompts and devices which they use in their dealings with defaulters. And from the defaulter's point of view, even somebody who say somebody had read my book, for instance, and they'd read all about the kind of techniques that might be used against them, I would say that probably wouldn't necessarily really help them. Ultimately, because they still are confronting the opacity of things like collections companies in the States who randomly put a portion of their debt portfolio through the legal process just to test the efficacy and the profitability of the legal process as compared to another set who won't be. There's absolutely no way of an individual knowing whether they're the particular set of prompts they're receiving are because these are prompts that they should be read in a straightforward way, or because they're part of a kind of a process of experimentation designed for the reasons that I talked about. And then within individual letters, it's very hard then to know how to read the particular solicitations they receive. When they receive a threat, when they receive a threat or a potential solicitation, sometimes collectors send out things like offers, say, well, if you pay today, you'll get a discount off your debt. So these are quite positive solicitations. It's impossible to know whether you should wait. Should you wait until the next solicitation comes? Will you get a better offer in the future? These are the questions that it becomes impossible to resolve. So there is this deep opacity at the heart of the defaulter collector encounter, and therefore I'd say a deep opacity at the heart of credit, which I think any kind of naive call for transparency would really not do much to challenge. So that's kind of a more pessimistic note. The more positive, I guess, note, we need to ask, what can we do to change? I mean, I guess the question is who we is. I mean, I'd say it's not necessary. When you look at the kind of most inspiring sites of resistance, I think some of these dynamics comes not from analysts and from academics and from policymakers. It comes from debtors themselves. And I kind of end at the very end of the book looking at just one example of some of these sites of resistance, which are these online debtor forums that have sprung up here in the UK. So the Consumer Action Group forums. Also, there are similar sites in the US where what you find, and they're very messy, these sites, you know, there's lots going on these sites. But what you find in moments in these sites are acts of quite vocal resistance and critique of the credit industry and potentially the sort of broader socioeconomic conditions and relations that surround the credit industry.
Yeah, that make credit a sort of bedrock of how we do society.
And, yeah.
You know, make it impossible to avoid.
And, that's right. And
for think, some sections.
And I think crucially what's really interesting about these kind of sites is that these are discussions that are happening in public. I mean, this obviously is the anonymity that these sites are for, but still you have these discussions happening in public. Debtors are talking with other debtors about their debts, which is something that's fairly unprecedented in the history of modern credit. But I think almost kind of more important is you kind of have people acting to support one another through the kind of process of managing default. So people upload letters, people ask for advice, people sort of say, well, you know, I've got this phone call that's asked me to do this, what should I do? And this acts of this kind of really, as I say, messy kind of bottom-up, I mean, you don't want to kind of idolise it too much, kind of, but nonetheless, kind of bottom-up kind of response to some of these crucial problematics of our age. And, you know, alongside that, there are things like strike debt and the kind of Rolling Jubilee campaigns, which I think are also really important. But in a way, I think that these kind of debtor-led forums perhaps might be kind of, well, I think they certainly provide a novel way of understanding, I think, some of the problematics of default and some of the kind of the ways in which detachment from markets is being talked about and is being kind of negotiated by debtors themselves.
And is that the kind of thing you're working on in the future, or are you doing something completely different?
So I have worked with colleagues on these forums more. We've got some articles that we're working on, which are under review at the moment, which looks in more detail at some of these debtor forums. So John Montgomery and Liam Stanley, for instance. So yes, to a degree. I'm also working on a piece of research that looks at new credit scoring methodologies that are being deployed, in particular in the payday lending sector, where what you see is credit is increasing, is the set of online sites making credit decisions based, to a lesser extent, and to some extent, and in some cases, to no extent at all, less on people's credit scores, people's past histories with credit, and instead on an analysis of an extremely diverse set of data. This includes data about people's, particularly And this is the thing I've been looking at, people's online behaviour. So in the UK, the most prominent site that uses such techniques is Wonga. In Europe, there's a company called Credit Tech that's launched sites in Poland, in Spain, in other Eastern European countries. Credit Tech in particular claims that it doesn't rely on credit scores at all. Wonga does use credit scores, but as far as I've been able to determine, layers over credit scores is kind of some of this kind of analysis. And this uses some really peculiar data to try and as a basis for assessing credit. This includes things like what browser an individual is using, their screen resolution, their IP address. Credit Tech, this company I mentioned, European company, they ask their users to install a Facebook app. They're actually incentivized to do so. They have like a 10 zloty discount on the Polish site. When you install this Facebook app, you have a permission request which grants Credit Tech access into an almost bewildering array of data about you as an individual, drawing on your Facebook on your Facebook account. And I'm looking at this kind of nascent industry. It's still a small industry, but it is a global industry. And looking to try and understand with more precision what techniques are being used, and of course the politics of some of this.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. David Bryan. On this episode, I was talking to Joe DeVille about lived economies, defaults, consumer credit, debt collection, and the capture of effects.